We're really delighted to be holding today's event in such an iconic building with such an amazing reminder of the history of the region. We want to show a little bit of what the future can hold. We'd also like to thank our Re-energising Wales project sponsors for making today possible. They are the Hodge Foundation, the Friends Provident Charitable Foundation, and the Polden Puckham Charitable Foundation. We think there's going to be a lot of conversation all over social media today, and while we're delighted to have you tweeting, please could you make sure your phones are on silent. The hashtag is on the slides and should be on the slides and on your agenda. It's hashtag IWA Energy. The IWA, for those of you who aren't yet members, we do two things. One is we act as a platform for independent comment and debate. We're non-party political, non-aligned. We do that, we produce the Welsh Agenda, the longest standing current affairs magazine in Wales. And we also have a really eclectic and fascinating daily blog called Click on Wales and a series of debates currently in partnership with Cardiff University. That's the general side of what we do. The more specific side of what we do is where this piece of work sits under our economy and things that are important for the future economy of Wales. So our five policy and research groups, steered by groups of experts, practitioners and academics from across Wales. And this particular project is run by Shay Buckland-Jones, who's going to say more about the actual project itself and what we'll be launching in today's event. So, Shay, over to you.
Thanks, Auriel. And as Auriel said, I'm Shay Buckland-Jones. I coordinate the Re-energising Wales project. I was actually going to kick off and gloat about Cardiff making the Premier League and the football being in Swansea today, but it hasn't quite happened yet. Hopefully next week. So timing isn't great, but I feel the timing's quite good to talk about the Re-energising Wales project and some of the findings coming out of the project in terms of our work packages. It's just quite a good time to be launching some of our findings. 2017 was the greenest year ever in the UK. It's the first 24 hours without coal generation power. And the summer was the greenest summer ever with energy generation, more than half of it from energy generated from low carbon sources. And I think it's quite an interesting time with the energy transition, a lot of opportunities, a lot of barriers. So it's a good time to bring a load of people together from different sectors to discuss a way forward to Wales. And 2017 was quite interesting for Wales in particular to note a few things. The Welsh Government energy targets, obviously in terms of driving ambition in Wales. And I was at a Marine Energy Wales conference the week before last, and the Cabinet Secretary for Finance, Mark Drakeford, was talking about Wales having the opportunity to lead the world in sustainable energy. And I think a lot of the people in this room would agree that, you know, there is a massive potential to do that. After all, Wales has got a massive natural resource potential, so a massive renewable energy potential. And I think what we've started to do with Re-energising Wales is to start to provide an evidence base, start to provide the numbers that policymakers, industry, communities and others can start to use to debate the best way forward so Wales can start to reach its potential. If the slides work. So Re-energising Wales came out of an economic strategy for Wales paper wrote in 2015. And what that paper essentially said was Wales has a range of economic potential and renewable energy is one of those areas that can drive economic impact in Wales. So the IWA set up the Re-energising Wales project and it works towards an overall goal of meeting energy demands in Wales through renewable sources by 2035. It's a three-year project, so due to conclude in April next year. It's a steering group of experts from within and outside the energy sector, so developers, community groups, academia, industry, and a range of others who've come together to develop a range of six work packages, which we've designed to develop and drive a range of evidence based, a range of objectives to meet that overall ambition, and a range of short papers. So the short papers are policy papers focused on decarbonising transport and investment in renewables, so they kind of fill the gaps in the work packages. So we've designed six in total. Today sees the launch of the first two. So we're not kind of physically launching the first work package in today's event, but as of this morning, we've launched in partnership with Cardiff University a whole range of energy demand data for buildings across Wales. So for all buildings across Wales, we've got half-hourly energy data, which can be used by anyone and everyone to really understand the local energy demands of their buildings in their area and obviously develop plans to meet that demand through renewable energy sources or use it in whatever way they'd like to. So on our website, you can see that data, anyone and everyone can use it, and we'll be sending that to a whole range of interested parties. The second work package is the focus of today, so I'm not going to steal Professor Stewart Irvine's thunder and Johnny Gowdy from Regen. So Stewart's going to introduce the Swansea Bay City Region case study. Johnny Gowdy from Regen's going to talk about the overall findings of that case study. And the only thing I will say is that in looking at a regional study, we feel that the Swansea Bay City Region's got massive potential to act as a pathfinder for other regions in Wales and other regions beyond the UK as such. The third work package, so led by Professor Calvin Jones today, he's really looking at the economic impacts of what we're doing in terms of meeting that overall vision of demand through renewables. And Professor Calvin Jones is going to give us some of the emerging findings in terms of the economic impacts later today as well. The fourth really is quite central to the work we're doing. So how do you really make sure you retain benefit in terms of meeting demand through renewables? How do you make sure there's as much social and local community ownership as possible? And Welsh Government are doing quite a lot of work around this at the moment, and we feel it's massive to meet in our vision. And we're working with Judith Markwin and Wizard to really understand the barriers and opportunities for local organisations to own renewable energy assets. The fifth is all about the regulatory, the kind of necessary regulations and powers that we feel like we need in Wales to meet our overall vision of demand for renewables by 2035. And then at the start of 2019, we're bringing together all those findings from the first five work packages into what we call a renewable energy plan for Wales. So in January or February 2019, we'll be launching a plan with bringing together all that evidence base. I'm not going to say too much more. I just want to say a few thanks before handing over. Thanks initially to the steering group for their support in driving the project to date and obviously on towards next year. Thanks to the organisations we've commissioned to do the work to date, so Professor Ian Knight and colleagues at Cardiff University, Johnny Gowdy and colleagues at Regen, also Professor Stewart Irvine at Swansea University as the steering group lead for the Swansea Bay City Region case study, and also thanks to the IWA staff for all their support in helping me drive this work. So, without ado, I'm going to introduce Professor Stewart Irvine. He's going to give an introduction into the Swansea Bay City Region case study.
Well, thank you. This is a very exciting day. This is a day we've been preparing for, I suppose, for about 2 years. It took us quite a while to really understand and get our heads around what a holistic energy plan for Wales would mean. And we decided that we would actually focus on one region of Wales, so the Swansea Bay City region. I'll say more about that in a moment. I want to set some context, first of all, because obviously we're partners of in a global context. And we're all playing and want to play our part towards future energy generation and carbon reduction. This is from the IEA, World Energy Outlook 2017, and they're projecting forward to 2040, which is not too different to our 2035 projection for this particular study in Swansea Bay City region. What you see here is that all of the yellow areas are where the amount of energy required is going to increase. So we're looking globally, because of developing economies, of increasing the amount of energy. In the developed economies, such as in Europe, we're looking at actually a reduction of the amount of energy. So when we talk about reducing an energy efficiency, for most of the world, they're trying to catch up, and it's really important to remember that. So if we look at the if we look at how that breaks down, the World Energy Outlook looked at two periods, historically, 2016, from 2010. This is the average annual net capacity addition. So this is the amount of additional energy from each of those energy vectors, coal, gas, nuclear, and renewables. You see that in this period 2010 to 2016, renewables started to increase the capacity. In fact, the greater capacity was from renewables. That's something that for many of us, we've been hoping to see for many years now, from renewables being a very small part of the mix, it's now becoming very significant, certainly in terms of the additions. And then if you project forward, so the bars underneath, renewables dominates even more, and this is broken down with solar PV, wind, and other renewables. And because my own research is actually in solar photovoltaics, I was very pleased to see the statement. I don't think you can all see it at the bottom from the World Energy Outlook, but I'll read it. Rapid deployment of solar photovoltaic PV, led by China and India, helps solar become the largest source of low-carbon capacity by 2040, by which time the share of renewables in total power generation reaches 40%. So this is becoming big business. So this is the context that we're looking at. We're part of this global context. So Swansea Bay City region, what we're looking at now is bottom-up rather than top-down. We see a lot of top-down in terms of targets set for renewable energy, for other forms of energy. And what we wanted to do was to say, well, actually, if you're going to make it happen, you've got to get it happening within the regions. You've got to get it happening within the communities. It's got to make sense. And this is one of the things we're really grappling with this work package, because you can't just look at one particular aspect. You've got to look at the connectivity, as I call it, joining the dots, with energy demand, with different forms of energy generation. And that's what the study, which will be presented today by Johnny Gowdy in a moment, that's what it will do. So Work Package 2, which I've had the privilege to lead that work study group, we're going to focus on just one region of Wales. And the reason for that is that actually if you look at Wales as a whole, as an energy entity, it sort of doesn't make sense. Now, I know the Welsh Government are very keen to set targets and so on. That's really important. And to enable greater use of renewable energy. But actually, we believe the way to do it is to build it up from the region. So bottom-up approach. So each region of Wales has a different energy mix. And each should aspire to achieving less than 50 grams CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour. At present, you know, we've got energy generation, electricity generation, which is 200, 300 kilowatt hours, sorry, grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. If we get it below that, then we're looking towards a sustainable future. That's an important figure. And that's one that I want you to really bear in mind. And that was a challenge for ReGen in terms of, can we do it by 2035? The scenarios for the methodology we set, and we looked at many different scenarios, it's ambitious but realistic. And again, that's something to bear in mind when you see these results. And we'd like your views, obviously, on how you view the way that this has been targeted. Innovation will play an important part in achieving the goals. So don't just think just what we have now, but think what we can drive with innovation. And we've got a lot of innovation potential within Wales to do that. And another question, another challenge, will it be possible to generate the equivalent of 100% of SBCR's net electricity? This is net electricity. We're not looking at sort of, you know, islanding energy within Swansea Bay City region. We have interconnects and so on. But in net energy, could we supply 100% of our electricity by 2035 by optimizing the generation of renewable energy, looking at all the different renewable energy sources? So that was another really important challenge, and you'll hear the answer in a moment. So very quickly, it's ambitious and it's inclusive. You know, we haven't missed out areas of energy such as heat and so on, which are really very challenging in terms of decarbonizing. We've included everything, because that's the only way which will make sense in terms of genuinely having a sustainable low-carbon energy economy. So electricity, we're looking at a whole range of renewable energies which are available within Swansea Bay City region. And Swansea Bay City region makes a really good choice because we've got onshore, we've got offshore, we've got marine, we've got bioenergy. You know, there's a lot of different opportunity, and we can look at the mix, and the mix is really important. Heat, domestic consumers, commercial buildings and processes, including the public sector, industrial buildings and processes, transport. Transport, you know, this was quite a difficult one to tackle, but within transport, which included private vehicles, Obviously, we're thinking about electric vehicles and what sort of penetration there might be by 2035. Commercial vehicles and light goods vehicles, public road transport, including buses. It doesn't include things which you can't attribute easily to the Swansea Bay City region, such as shipping and aviation. But it includes everything else. So it's very ambitious to actually take that as a study. So, yeah, balancing the system, you know, there's no point saying we're going to generate lots and lots of renewable energy and we're not too sure where it's going to be used, when it's going to be used. And this is where the work package one has really helped in having some half-hour data in terms of energy demand. So we need to look at that. And again, the study addresses this. Does it actually cause problems for the grid in terms of importing or exporting electricity from Swansea Bay City region at the certain critical times? Can we actually balance it if we have 100% net renewable energy? So smart, how are we going to do it? Well, these are the challenges. These are the areas which Johnny will be addressing. Smart demand, local energy storage, utility scale storage, and of course import and export, but not overstressing the connectors. We don't want the whole system to keel over because we're generating so much renewable energy. Consider different diurnal scenarios, considering periods of maximum demand and maximum supply. Okay, so to finish up, these are the regions of Wales. We think that it makes sense to actually look at energy balance, supply and demand, and renewable energy in terms of the different regions. The methodology which has been developed in this work package, we believe is applicable to the other regions of Wales. So although today is about the Swansea Bay City region, it's actually about all the regions of Wales. And I'm very excited at the opportunity that we will have to look then at what will happen, what the potential is for other regions in Wales. But today we're looking at Swansea Bay City region, and of course it fits very well with the city deal. And one of the main themes within that is energy. And I hope that this IWA study will help to inform both the Swansea Bay City region in terms of achieving their ambitions, as well as Welsh Government in terms of achieving ambitions for renewable energy across Wales. Thank you. I now introduce Johnny Gowdy from Regen. He'll give all the good data.
Thanks very much, Stuart, and it's lovely to be here today. I feel like I've got a difficult job because I've got half an hour to explain how a whole energy system works and all the detail of that, and obviously I'm not going to be able to do that in so much detail, but I hopefully will be able to highlight some of the key findings from the study and perhaps pose a few questions as well, which we can then pick up on when we come to the Q&A sessions and the discussion this afternoon about how we take it forward. You've heard a little bit about Regen so far, but I should just say that we are a not-for-profit organisation providing market insights, support, advice. We're energy specialists, basically, and within that, sustainable and renewable energy specialists, I should say. One thing I'll just say is I've really enjoyed doing this piece of work, actually. It's really posed some challenging questions. It's been very complicated. There's lots of different aspects. As Stuart said, we're looking holistically at all the different sources of demand and supply for energy, which is something you don't get to do very often. And I've also very much enjoyed working with the IWA and the steering group. I think we've had some excellent input from experts in industry, academia, and also people that are committed to green energy, renewable energy, and tackling climate change. So it's been a really invigorating piece of work for us and for the team at Regen. The way we approached it, it's a big question we were asked, you know, what would a future energy system for Swansea Bay City Region look like? And we broke it into two phases. The first phase of work was really about trying to understand the current situation in Swansea Bay City Region, what's the current demand, the current energy generation profile, and then working with the steering group to come up with a set of more specific objectives and aims which the study would then progress. So we produced a report in November 2017, which really set out the scope, some of the underlying assumptions that we were going to make, and the key objectives and vision, which the study was then going to explore in more detail. What we're launching today, then, is the second phase of work, which is really taking that input, looking at the modelling, looking at the design of a future energy system. I'd call it a case study, actually. I mean, there's many ways of getting to a renewable future, and I wouldn't say that this is trying to be a prescriptive kind of cookbook solution, and a lot's going to change over the next 5 to 10 years as well. So, I mean, we had to make some decisions about which technologies to focus on and which areas we felt had the best potential within the Swansea Bay City region, either from the point of view of resource, also potential in terms of economic opportunity, innovation and jobs. But that's not to rule out any of the other technologies that we might have passed over rather quickly. You've heard a little bit about the objectives, and it was quite challenging, I have to say. Energy efficiency, a 20% reduction in energy efficiency overall, both domestic and commercial and industrial. That's in line with what the Committee on Climate Change say we need to achieve by 2035 to be on track for a net zero carbon in 2050. Renewable electricity, equivalent to 100% of consumption. So we weren't treating Swansea Bay City region as an island. We didn't say you can only use electricity from within the region. We accepted a degree of imports and exports. But over the course of the year, we wanted to make sure we were generating sufficient electricity to meet the overall consumption, which I think is the approach that the Welsh Government will take as well, because obviously Wales is also connected to England and through England into Europe, and we don't want to reduce that degree of integration in energy systems. Getting down below 50 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour, again, that's what the Committee on Climate Change says we need to achieve in order to then be in a position to kick on and get down to net zero by 2050, or actually under the Paris Agreement, probably in the 2040s is when we need to get to net zero. Heat, I'll talk about in a minute, is the most difficult area. So we set ourselves a target there of 40% of heat from decarbonized sources. Decarbonized sources doesn't mean zero carbon, but it means that those sources are low carbon or have had carbon reduced, if you like, through things like biomethane or hydrogen or through electrification. Reducing the overall CO2 footprint of heat by 40% against current emissions. Transport, we set ourselves a target, bearing in mind the sort of backstop of all diesel petrol cars going by 2040, of 80% of new cars being either electric or also ultra-low emission vehicles by 2035, and at least a third of those vehicles being ultra-low emissions. Public transport, 100% needs to be ultra-low emission vehicles. I'd say by 2035, actually, it needs to be done much earlier than that, and most public transport will be, I hope, decarbonized ultra-low by at least the mid-2020s, if not earlier. We were asked also to think about supporting local generation, and difficult to put some targets on that, but we thought that we'd limit the amount of import into the region to 15%, under 15%. So that gave us something to target in terms of trying to achieve that sort of balancing that Stuart was talking about. So using smart grid, using energy storage, using local energy systems, local balancing, local energy generation, local clubs to try to achieve that type of level. And we also set a rather arbitrary limited that we wanted to make sure we didn't have any imports over 450 megawatts, so a peak import limit. In reality, there isn't really a peak import limit into Swansea Bay City region. Actually, I think National Grid said there's 3 to 4 gigawatts of import capacity. So that isn't a real challenge, but I think we wanted to make sure that we were actually pushing ourselves to say, well, just how self-sufficient, just how efficient could this city region be? And a lot of that would be done through using flexibility and demand side measures as well. Each of those individual objectives would be quite difficult if you were looking at them in isolation. But of course, what we were trying to do was to deliver an energy system or design an energy system which would deliver all of those objectives at the same time. So we needed to take a holistic approach. We needed to bring together streams of demand, generation, understand how flexibility, energy storage, and other technologies could be used. So to do that, we've actually created what I would call an integrated energy system model. At the core of it was a kind of a balancing model, and we used Wales and West Utilities Pathfinder simulator as a starting point for that. And then into that, we fed in a transport feed in terms of demand and supply, demand and energy efficiency, generation, flexibility, and heat, all coming together into that kind of central model. If you look at the report, the last two chapters kind of explain how that's done. I'm not really going to go into that in too much detail today because it is quite sort of technical, but if anybody wants to talk about that, then I'm happy to do that offline. What I will do is give you some highlights from the case study, and I've had to restrict myself. I've only got 25 minutes left, so I've picked out what I think are some of the key findings. There's lots of other data and information in the report. As Shay said, this is meant to be an evidence base. It's meant to inform people. So there is quite a lot of detail in the report itself, which I won't be able to go through today. So highlights. Energy efficiency. The target was 20% reduction in energy demand. We spent quite a lot of time looking at the domestic sector in our analysis. We looked at the electricity performance certificate data over the last decade to come up with a kind of profile of where we thought Swansea Bay City region was. And you could see that at the moment, over 70% of domestic properties in Swansea Bay City region are classified D to G in the EPC kind of banding, and about 28% are classified A to C. So to achieve our 20% reduction, we need to almost flip that. We need to actually move at least 60% of properties into the A to C banding. There's a number of ways we could do that. We looked at three different scenarios, one across the board, looking at all houses, another one perhaps focused a little bit more on those houses that are poor performing in terms of energy efficiency, and the third scenario with a little bit more focus on getting to the A's and B's, so maybe focusing a little bit more on the exemplars and case studies. What was interesting for me about that was it was around about 200,000 properties would have to have a significant energy efficiency improvement to go up at least one banding. And that 200,000 properties represents about two-thirds of the properties within the Swansea Bay City region. So that's one of the big challenges, but as we'll talk about in a minute, it's also one of the big opportunities. I mean, a wholesale improvement in domestic energy efficiency would then create significant carbon savings and significant savings for households. In fact, we did some rough calculations, and we've used Bayes' own analysis on the energy bills for different EPC bandings. And if we're able to achieve that energy efficiency saving, we'd be saving somewhere between £350 and £420 per household per year on their energy bills. That's heat and electricity. So, not insignificant amount of saving, as you'd expect if you undertook that sort of a program. The carbon saving, 100,000 metric tons per year CO2 from that measure, from those measures alone per annum. Electricity, again, the target there was 100% renewables or equivalent 100% renewables of consumption. We had quite a lot of data on the existing energy mix. Regen's previously worked with the Welsh Government to produce an analysis of energy generation in Wales. We're able to draw on that. That goes up to end of 2016. We're able then to add in those projects that we'd identified that had been deployed in 2017. So of the big ones, solar PV, 340 megawatts installed across the region, and wind, onshore wind, 360 megawatts installed across the region. We looked at a number of different scenarios of how you could achieve a mix that would deliver that energy from low carbon sources. The base case scenario we came to would see a jump to just over 2.7 gigawatts of renewable energy capacity. A few highlights there. Offshore wind. We think in order to achieve the solution, we need an offshore wind farm off the South Wales coast. I don't think that would serve only Swansea Bay City region, but Swansea Bay City region would obviously take a proportion of that, particularly if it is supported and built from the ports of Swansea and Port Talbot and Pembroke. We could talk a little bit more about that in a minute, because I think that's one of the big opportunity areas that we saw offshore renewables generally. Onshore wind, a doubling of capacity to 800 megawatts. Again, that would require looking again at the Tern 8 areas, looking again at support for offshore wind, both in terms of subsidy support and in terms of planning support. Solar over 1.2 gigawatts, which is quite a lot of solar in the mix. I don't think you'd have quite as much solar if you were looking at the whole of Wales or the whole of the UK, but being on the south coast, being relatively high irradiance levels, Swansea Bay City region does have good opportunities in solar, both roof-mounted and also roof-mounted and building-integrated, as well as a ground-mounted. We've included the Swansea Bay Tidal Lagoon within the base case. Obviously, it's an important Pathfinder project, a really important strategic project for the region with a lot of support here, and that would really kickstart not just tidal range, but offshore renewables generally, and support as well tidal stream and wave energy, where in our modelling we've got, I would say, early commercial projects up to 100 megawatts by 2030, 2035, which is consistent with the build-out on the demonstration zones. In the report, you'll find a couple of other scenarios. So we had a scenario with a higher level of wind, so slightly less solar, slightly more wind, particularly onshore wind, and we had a scenario without the Swansea Bay Tidal Lagoon, which would require a more offshore wind in particular, and perhaps a build-out of tidal and wave energy. As I say, there isn't one solution, but funny enough, actually, the electricity part of this wasn't the most difficult. I know there's a lot in here in terms of investment and support and planning, etc., but all of those areas are, if you like, under the control of policymakers. If we wanted to do it, we could do it. We've done it over the last 5 years, where we've built over 3 gigawatts in Wales and 25 gigawatts across the UK. The most difficult parts actually were the bits that involve lots of people undertaking energy efficiency measures or installing heat pumps, etc. Much more difficult to do from a societal point of view. The electricity mix, electricity generated locally from renewables would have a carbon intensity of just over 20 grams per kilowatt hour. If we include then the imported electricity that we would need to top that up, which we brought in at 200 grams per kilowatt hour, which is a blend, if you like, of fossil fuel and renewables from the rest of the UK and from Europe, we would achieve under 44 grams per kilowatt hour, so within the target that had been set at 50. To some extent, this is a little bit arbitrary. I mean, you could change the mix, you could change some of the assumptions, but I think what we're showing here is that with the right mix of electricity, you could certainly achieve that target of less than 50 grams per kilowatt hour. Heat, much more difficult. We don't have the technologies, certainly easily deployable technologies, that would radically change the heat mix. You could see at the moment the heat mix is predominantly gas, 85% of the heat energy in the Swansea Bay City region coming from gas, the rest oil, LPG, a bit of biomass, quite slow uptake of heat pumps to date, similar to the rest of Wales and the rest of the UK, I have to say, so not exceptionally low, but obviously those renewable energy technologies for heat are more difficult to deploy and involve a lot more, if you like, consumer awareness and consumer acceptance, which we haven't quite got yet. So our strategy from heat was really to look at a number of different opportunities. Energy efficiency we've already talked about, so first of all reducing the demand for heat. Electrification of heat, so if we got low carbon electricity we could use heat pumps and other technology to reduce the heat carbon footprint. Gas decarbonisation, so if we have to use the gas network, and we will use the gas network, what can we do to reduce its carbon footprint by, for example, injection of biomethane or hydrogen? Renewable heat technologies, so let's look at biomass, let's look at biomethane, other technologies that we can apply to generate heat directly, either through CHP or potentially through district heat networks, which was the other kind of tactic, if you like, of how we could actually decarbonise heat. And what we come up with then is a new kind of heat delivery system, which is shown in the graphic on the right. Mains gas, or the mains gas network, I should say, is still delivering 65% of heat, but it's been decarbonized itself through injection of biomethane and hydrogen. We've got standalone systems, biomass, biomethane. We've got heat pumps, including hybrid heat pumps. And then we've got district heat networks. Now, a couple of things in there that some people might object to. Some people might say, well, why are we still using the mains gas network in 2035? Can't we get away from that completely? And I think the answer, certainly from us and from the steering group, was, well, actually, no. I don't think the technologies are there at the moment and in that time frame to completely move away from having a mains gas network. So our best option is to try to work with that infrastructure, which delivers heat to our homes, and see what we can do to decarbonize that. Within the heat pump section of the report, you'll find a big discussion about hybrid heat pumps. So for those of you that might not be aware, these are heat pump systems that also have a backup. The backup might be gas, it might be biomass, it might be something else. It might even be oil or LPG if we're talking about off-grid properties in rural areas. As a pure, renewable, sustainable person, I don't like the idea of people using a backup that might be fossil fuels. But the reality is that if we are going to see heat pumps deployed en masse to those hard-to-treat properties, then probably that's a compromise we need to make. But we need to think very carefully about the rules, if you like, or how we manage the deployment of heat pumps to make sure that that backup is used as little as possible. And within our modelling, we managed to get the backup down to less than 30% of the energy generation. So 70% of the heat was being delivered by the heat pump system. Overall, then, we've achieved the target, 40% of heat delivered from decarbonised sources, renewables and electricity, and including within that the decarbonised element of the gas, so the bit that's delivered by hydrogen and biomethane. And we've managed to reduce the overall carbon footprint of heat below 41%, reduce it by 41%, but that does include the energy efficiency measures that I talked about previously. Is that ambitious enough? I mean, I think that's a discussion to be had, actually, in the next stage. We would like to get further with heat, but I think it's commonly accepted that heat is probably the most challenging area to address. Transport. We've done quite a lot of analysis of the existing mix, the fleet, if you like, within Swansea Bay City region, understanding the number of vehicles, vehicle miles, and therefore the carbon footprint. There is some electric vehicles already deployed. It's not a lot, but we're talking about just under 600 electric vehicles in cars and 120-odd in light goods vehicles, which is actually quite similar to what's happening in the southwest of England as well. And we set ourselves a target in the modelling of 80% new cars by 2035 would be ULEV, ultra-low emission. 34% of all those cars would be electric by 2035. Lights good vehicles, slightly lower target, but nevertheless, significant increase in ultra-low emission vehicles. Public transport, 100%, as I said earlier on, and HGVs, a lower target of 30%, which would be a mixture of hydrogen, I guess, biofuel and electric heavy goods vehicles. Quite a lot of that was based on working back from the ban that had come in, or the ban the government's proposing for 2040, which already people are saying is not ambitious enough, and maybe we should move that up to 2035 or 2030. So I think, in hindsight now, if I was redoing these objectives, I might be a bit more bullish on the electricity side, on the transport side. I think actually the momentum now, particularly with manufacturers bringing out new models of vehicles, is such that we could be a little bit more ambitious. But to be frank, we don't really know, and Regen produced a report a couple of weeks ago looking at the transport revolution. We had three models within that: exponential growth, so starting from a low base and then ramping up later in the 2020s and 2030s. Explosive growth, where we meet some sort of a threshold, I guess, when electric cars are cheap, when cities begin to bring in zero carbon zones, etc., and we see that explosive growth happening. Or a scenario where we see stagnated growth, where the policy measures and perhaps the manufacturers aren't really there, or the consumers aren't willing to accept the change that it would mean in terms of their lifestyle and transport choices. So the model at the moment is based on exponential growth, but I think there is a case that we might see explosive growth, and I think that actually is very important for policymakers and people in city deals, for example, to think about how their cities, how their urban areas are actually set up and ready to cope with a radical change in transport that might come within the next 5 years. System balancing and sources of flexibility. So one of the challenges we had wasn't just can we generate sufficient energy, but what would the system look like and how can we minimise the amount of energy that's exported or imported? How can we make sure that the energy system works in an efficient way? So we've looked very much at system balancing. I must say system balancing is slightly different to system operability, actually, in terms of the sort of minutiae of how it will be managed. So we've looked at the relatively high level. We had a whole year to play with, half-hourly data, temperature, weather, demand profiles, generation profiles. We were able to play around with that and then bring in some of these measures like hybrid heat pumps. So when the demand is very high, the weather's very cold, we could then bring in the backup systems to actually manage some of that heat delivery. Controllable renewable energy generation, so CHP plants, AD plants, biomass, etc., which to some extent can be managed and tailored to when peak demand is there or peak price is there. Time of use tariffs, relatively, dumb measure actually in terms of managing balancing, but shifting peak demand to off-peak periods. Optimized smart energy, so where the market is actually responding, where people are changing or people's apps or technologies or applications are actually adjusting demand to take advantage of lower price periods, or perhaps it's to take advantage of local generation if you're part of an energy club or a local generation tariff, for example. Managed smart energy, which is slightly different, where maybe network operators or third parties are making decisions about charging electric vehicles, perhaps looking again to avoid peak demand periods or peak imbalance periods to take advantage of better market prices. And then energy storage, which is something that we could use. We focus very much on reducing imports. And when I say import, I mean either imported electricity or backup electricity, so fossil fuel backup electricity. On the export side, one of our kind of trump cards was, well, we could use excess electricity to generate hydrogen. And the level of hydrogen within the model is equivalent to, if it was created by electrolysis, is equivalent to about 80% of the excess renewable electricity, which doesn't have a local source of demand. So we're able to mop up quite a lot of that export through that. Overall, then, we've managed to reduce imports, exports down to, sounds very precise, 12.3%. It's not meant to be that precise, but let's say it's below 15%. The peak electricity requirement in terms of import would be 450 megawatts, so we've managed to keep that within that cap. I mean, just think about that for a minute. 450 megawatts in Swansea Bay City Region is equivalent to about 48% of peak demand. So that is quite a lot of import needed, albeit only for a short period of time. In fact, the amount of imports over 350 megawatts was 180 hours a year where we'd need to have that kind of import. So it goes to show that it's actually very difficult to isolate a region without having connectivity. That wasn't the intention, but it kind of gives you an idea that you do need to have import or backup at certain times through the year. There's a lot more detail in the report. We've broken it down by month, by day, and we've isolated certain periods. And just if anybody's around on the 19th of January 2035, you might want to think about this. That was the worst day in the year, and it's interesting, it came about because we'd had 2 days, simulated days, of very low wind, very cold temperature, we'd used up the energy storage capacity that was available, we'd used up quite a lot of the sources of flexibility, and on the second day, we had the peak demand imbalance, which was before, I should say, before the optimization or managed demand came in, of 533 megawatts. And by using managed demand, we were able to bring that back down to 450. And that is actually pretty realistic. I mean, if the wind doesn't blow for several days on the trot and we have cold weather, then we will need to rely on other forms of energy. I think I've got a couple of minutes left. What I want to do, just to finish up, and I was asked to do this, was to pick my, if you like, top 5 opportunities. Within the report, there are probably tens, if not hundreds, of opportunities that people could mine and look at and see what the opportunity areas are. But for me, anyway, the top 5 were... I should say the challenges, actually. I mentioned before, energy generation isn't the biggest challenge, I don't think. I think it's things like 200,000 households with energy efficiency measures, 50,000 heat pumps, that's... 14% of properties with heat pumps, for example. Will biomethane be commercialized? There's plenty of resource there, but can we commercialize that resource? It's those kind of softer areas of policy, not softer areas, it's those kind of slightly more secondary areas of policy that really drive the renewable future, not can we build enough PV or can we put up enough wind turbines, because we know that we can do that if there is a political will. So my top 5... net zero carbon buildings as power stations. Sorry, the formatting of the slide's gone a little bit there. 200,000 properties with improved energy efficiency, that's 60% of households. 50,000 properties with heat pumps. 75,000 properties with rooftop or integrated PV. And 350 megawatts of storage, of which a proportion will be domestic storage and storage located at commercial industrial properties. You put all that together, and that's a massive program of work, but what you would get at the end of it is buildings as power stations. You could actually transform buildings from being energy demand, if you like, energy consumers, to being buildings where you could generate power, store electricity, and use it to support the overall energy system and the grid. My second big opportunity is offshore renewables and offshore wind and marine energy in particular. I mean, if you look at what government is saying, UK government is saying, we need at least another 20 gigawatts of offshore renewables by 2030, 2035. It could actually be more than that. And I don't think all of that could or will be built in the North Sea. Therefore, there's an opportunity for us to look again at offshore wind farms and other offshore renewables on the western seaboard of the UK. And Wales is in a prime position, both in terms of energy resource, supply chain, ports, infrastructure, to deliver that. Also, particularly within Swansea Bay City Region, lots of technology innovation going on there. Tidal lagoons, wave energy, tidal stream energy, for instance, down at Pembroke Port, for example. So Wales and Swansea Bay City Region has an opportunity to become a real powerhouse in terms of offshore renewable energy. I think we need to move very quickly to look for an offshore wind farm, the decision on Swansea Bay Tidal Lagoon, for example, and also then to support the organisations. I've put up Marine Energy Wales's logo there because I think they're one of the key organisations to deliver this that are looking at making Wales a centre for offshore renewable energy. Number three in my list is maximising the potential of bioenergy. Biomethane, bioenergy, or bio-SNG from biomass crops up throughout the model, injection to the grid, using it directly to provide energy, CHP plants, district heat networks. If you add it all up together, it's 1.6 terawatt hours of biomethane energy required as a fuel, which is just about what there is available at present according to the studies that have been done. The big thing, though, is that all of that needs to be commercialized. At the moment, you'd call that theoretical potential rather than there is the commercialization of those fuels. Lots of opportunities from waste feedstocks, food, sewage, residual waste, wood, and agriculture, particularly forestry and agriculture, farming. As well, need to look at energy for crops for energy as well. I think the commercialization of that, big opportunity for Welsh farmers, Swansea Bay City Region, rural area, lots of forestry as well, planting trees. I know that's one of Shay's big things, and I certainly agree we need to look again at how we manage those forests to make sure we maximise that potential. Fourth area, smart and flexible, the whole drive towards local ownership, local usage, democratisation of energy, I think, is very much supported by this. That's going to be picked up in one of the later work streams in the Energising Wave programme. We've certainly looked at, within our modelling, you know, using demand-side response, using local energy clubs like Bethesda, sort of model that you have there, where people are actually changing their demand profiles to take advantage of lower tariffs when the electricity is being generated. Thinking ahead, peer-to-peer, I've got to say the word blockchain because everyone says it in presentations, digital platforms that will enable people to trade amongst each other. That's a really big opportunity for Wales. And I think driven by that passion for local ownership, Wales could put itself at the forefront of that that movement. And the fifth area that I've chosen is the transport revolution. And it's not just about cars, HGVs and LGVs and electrification. It's about having really good joined up transport strategies that brings in public transport, walking, cycling, active transport, and thinking very carefully about if we are electrifying transport, where are we going to put those chargers, making sure sensible decisions are made that then reinforces public transport, other modes of transport, so we have a really joined up approach. And the opportunity there, I guess, I mean, it's obvious, a side of innovation and jobs that will come from new technology, but clean air and healthier people. And then looking at legislation in Wales and the acts that have been brought in recently, that is really, really important from a Welsh government point of view, and I think from a Welsh people point of view as well. So quite a lot to digest there, and I'm hoping that some of those questions we can return to in the Q&A session in a moment. I haven't talked very much about making it happen and the sort of steps that would be needed to make it happen. Professor Irvine said about that regional approach, that bottom-up approach, and I think that's right. It's about making sure that regions, Welsh Government, are working in harmony, that those targets that are set at a higher level are then actioned and brought down to what can be delivered. I think as well there'll be a discussion, no doubt, this afternoon about the power and the levers that the Welsh Government has vis-a-vis the UK Government. Offshore wind, for example, at the moment, most of that strategy has been set in Westminster, and I think it's really important that, as the Scots have done, that the Welsh Government does take control of that and has, perhaps has a bigger say in terms of how offshore renewables are deployed in Wales. I think I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. I'm not quite sure what happens next. Sorry, Calvin. So Calvin Jones from Cardiff University, who's going to talk about the economic impact of the future energy system vision for Swansea Bay City Region.
Thanks very much, Johnny. So my job is to bring you all down from the heights of possibility with the cold, hard cash of reality. What I'm really keen to stress is, I underlined the word emerging there in a really cool MS Gothic font to make it doubly memorable. This work package on what all this will cost won't report fully until the end of June, when we'll be looking at the implications at Wales as well as Swansea Bay City region level. There's numbers here just to give you an indication of the sort of challenges financially and in terms of the decentralised energy Johnny was talking about, of the scenario that Johnny outlined. And it's important to know that this does follow from Johnny's scenario. So what I've done is taken the regen numbers in terms of required electricity interventions, investments, and the domestic refurbishment, and try to work out what that would mean in terms of upfront investment cost. So far, what we've done is we've had a look at the gross cost of some of these interventions. I'd say just on the first two parts of that that scenario, I'll explain why in a second, and then look at how much of that might remain in Wales, following from work we've done over the last almost 10 years now for various clients on energy kind of projects in Wales. We've got quite a good background in the Welsh Economy Research Unit in understanding where money goes when you spend it on energy projects in Wales. And then transferred that kind of net Welsh spend into an assessment of the economic impact of the scenarios, regen scenario, on Wales and the Swansea Bay City region. So we looked at the number of jobs and gross value added that might be generated if we did engage in this investment. And then I've got some stuff in on sort of the wider issues, how we might tentatively think about how we start to maximise or optimise some of this stuff, make sure we get what Wales needs out of it. And that's, I think, where, as Johnny says, that the easy thing in a way is sticking stuff on the hills. I mean, that's just almost trivially easy if the regulatory and financial environment is right. Getting the wider benefits for Wales from this is much more difficult than in some of the ways we've talked already. What's not doable, or at least not done so far, is the other vision elements. I mean, I did this kind of like a merit order in looking at what was made my life easiest in terms of what could be easily estimated in terms of investment cost, and then what elements I thought might have most impact locally. So I've concentrated on the renewable electricity investments and the domestic refurbishment, because they are the areas where the numbers are most solid, although they're not always completely solid, as you'll see. And things like storage, electricity storage, there is much less certainty about what the cost will be in terms of how many megawatt hours you can store, a bit like kind of battery or other storage medium. So it's more difficult to estimate the kind of investment cost required there. In other areas, such as vehicles, I'm not sure there's... firstly, the extent to which electric vehicles will require additional investment over a normal replacement of a vehicle is an open question. I mean, by mid-2020s, so when I'm looking to replace my car, it may be cheaper to get an electric rather than a fossil fuel vehicle. So I'm not sure they can model that kind of economic impact in the same way. And of course, we currently have one significant vehicle manufacturer just outside the city region. I suspect it won't be there in 2025. So the amount of that kind of vehicles investment which comes via spending back through to Swansea or even Wales is an open question, of course, depending on whether Wales gets on board as a manufacturer in the electric or bio vehicles kind of industry. What also I haven't really done is any systematic analysis. So unlike Johnny, which is very sophisticated, where we've got a lot of balancing, optimization, this is just, if we build all this stuff effectively over the next 15 years, with very little in the way of scheduling, although I'll come back to that in a minute. One of my big worries, and particularly for a small region like Wales, and particularly for a small city region like Swansea, is when you try and do more than one thing at the same time, your leakages in terms of economic impact will ramp up very quickly. So we're trying to build a metro and an M4 and a Swansea Bay renewable vision at the same time, then you will quickly find that we reach the ceiling in terms of particularly labour, skilled companies and so on, and obviously then you get higher levels of economic leakage. But I'll talk about that towards the end. In terms of methodology, it's important to recognise that quite a lot of this stuff is bespoke. So it's bespoke to Wales in terms of the model we use is a Welsh economic impact, input-output tables model. So we've used it for a lot of energy studies in the past. So it's kind of, the numbers you see will be like apples for apples in terms of studies you might have seen on tidal lagoon, on onshore wind, on marine renewables we've done in the past, and on other bits and pieces. So there's a lot of bespoke information in here in terms of the multipliers, the labour use, and so on. We've used those studies to estimate our cost and economic impact per megawatt installed by relevant technology. In a perfect world, you would do this maybe based on a levelised cost, but you can't really do that for some of the more novel technologies where load factors are unknown, and particularly things like fuel technology like AD and biomass. But we've done the best we can in working out what the cost would be by technology for the investment that Johnny's talked about. And then, because a lot of that data is oldish, 2013, 14, 15, we've rebased that as far as we can to 2018, based on now we've got a non-Welsh data sources like contracts of difference, for example, UK level, where we can see the fall in the cost per megawatt, for example, of offshore wind, onshore wind. We can try and track our older numbers to make sure that they're relevant to 2018. And also that, you know, when we look at things like, say, the tidal lagoon, that's gone the other direction. So that was going to be a £750 million investment. Now it's over £1 billion. So, you know, there's kind of rebalancing going on to get as close as we can to 2018 numbers, although I wouldn't claim they are kind of correct for current day. And then we've looked at the level of economic capture in the local Swansea Bay city region area. Now, we don't have an economic model for the city region, so it's a bit more kind of finger in the air guesstimate based on my extensive prior experience and a good bottle of Japanese whiskey. And I reckon we're probably looking at, if you know, in the optimistic case, and I'll talk about that at the end, the city region might capture between 60 and 70% of its economic impact, largely through kind of local construction, some element of supply chain. And I'll talk about the importance of getting that right in a second. And then obviously there's a lot of qualitative discussion in those reports I try to synthesize, or will try and synthesize as we go towards the summer. And these are the kind of key reports that we've got on the shelf to look at and try and assess what this means, this vision means in terms of the money that we spend on it and the jobs we create. A wide range of technologies covered there. But what I'm really keen to sort of emphasise is that there's no new work. I haven't gone out on the back of this project to look for new information, new data on kind of where we are currently with some of these technologies. We may be missing bits, which is where you guys come in, because you can tell me if I'm missing anything. Unfortunately, the IWA contract was insufficiently, what's the opposite of stingy? Anyway, there wasn't enough money to go out and do what we'd like to have done, which is have like £50,000 gone into a big new survey of kind of costs in some of these technologies. It just wasn't possible with the time scale and resources. So we've got desk-based research, but as good as it gets in terms of the material we've got. Now this is where we come to some of the numbers. You'll see that on the first column there is effectively a replication of Johnny's data in terms of what he thinks the kind of base scenario will do in terms of requiring 1.2 gigawatts of solar installed, 800 of onshore wind, offshore wind, and so on. It notes a couple of things in there. Firstly, tidal ranges in, so we've got the lagoon in there, And as you can see, it's very expensive. So if you look at the second column, we've got £4.1 million per megawatt. The Tidal Lagoon is a very important pathfinder, but of course part of the reason why it hasn't been given a go-ahead is because it's very expensive compared to things like offshore wind. So, you know, there's a merit order in terms of the cost of some of these installations, you know, obviously, which then you have to consider in terms of the energy mix and intermittency and so on. So although tidal range is expensive, it's also reliable. Every day, twice a day, the tide does what the tide does. So obviously these numbers are only one part of the story in terms of how you might develop your energy mix. There's a slight caveat here in that all these are as close as I can get to 2018 numbers, apart from the wave and tidal stream, where the Carbon Trust did a report a few years ago on wave and tidal stream, or marine renewables in general, and we did one in Wales a few years ago. And what's clear is that the cost reductions in that area will depend not only on time, but also on cumulative deployment. So, you know, until we start putting this stuff in the water and understanding what goes wrong, you know, what kinds of marine animals kind of swim into the turbines and get cut up and stuff, we won't know how much it costs. So what I've done there is I've used some artistic license, and the numbers you see in terms of wave and tidal stream are my best guess on roughly mid-2025 cost per megawatt based on the Carbon Trust's now slightly old report. And the fact we haven't really done much in terms of commercialised wave and tidal stream in the last 7 or 8 years, I think is something of a pessimistic note, and we won't worry about why. If I'm doing this report 4 or 5 years ago, I'd have the same set of data, because really tidal has not taken off in the way we might like, certainly in Wales and certainly in Pembrokeshire, despite the best efforts of people like Marine Energy Wales, of course, who try very hard. And you'll see that, you know, there is a different cost associated with putting some of this, you know, the easiest thing, leaving aside the question of intermittency and reliability, is, of course, it's been build loads and loads and loads of onshore wind, you know, as far as we can until it gets to a stage where topographically there's no more point. Of course, that requires a lot of grid build-out, which is not, again, not in this table. But you can see that if you just care about cost, it might give you a very different outcome than caring about system effects. And then, of course, some other plan one by the other, I guess, your overall system cost. No economies of scale in here, it's just purely linear. And then we come to an estimated cost just for the first kind of 1.5, 2 parts of Johnny's scenario, about £4.6 billion in 2018 money. So I've not got any kind of future discounting in here. If we were to spend this money starting now, looking to build this out, we'd be looking at between £4 and £5 billion just for the easy parts. So the parts around, the you know, technically easy parts around domestic refurbishment. It's not socially easy, it's technically easy, easier. And then electricity generation. And of course, with heat, this doesn't include grid kind of renewal. So obviously the national grid probably wouldn't be up to the job of accepting all these new renewables. And that's probably multiple billions on top of this for the city region. But you can see that even kind of starting at this level, just a partial study, you've got, you know, £4 or 5 billion to find. Of that, I think about 1.8 will be spent in Wales, largest because Wales doesn't make much stuff. We don't make any turbines in Wales. Even the turbines for Swansea, Tidal Lagoon wouldn't be made in Wales. If we're lucky, they might be made in Rugby. So, you know, we lose all that value added, all that kind of really important, interesting kind of manufacturing fabrication, because we don't do it in Wales, and we're unlikely to start in the next 5 or 10 years, at least in these kind of more mature technologies like wind. And that percentage captured locally will vary by technology. So moving on then to what this means in terms of economic impact, I'll talk about what I mean by economic impact when I come to the end. You know, I reckon this would take around 35,000 person years of employment in Wales to put onto the hillsides on the wave. That's based on obviously the prior work we've done on already built out and suggested technologies so over the last 5 to 10 years in the work we've done, which is, you know, a significant employment impact. It's about 1.1 billion of gross value added over the next 15 years. So it's not, you know, this is not a transformative investment for Wales. It's doable, I think, in terms of the supply side. It's not going to make Wales suddenly rich, and that's largely because Wales doesn't capture much in the way of value added from energy. You know, we capture a bit of labour value added, a little bit of bits and pieces in terms of land rent and professional services, but really don't You know, most of the money being made in the current kind of ownership paradigm and regulatory paradigm, it won't get made in Wales. So this is why we don't really see very transformative economic impacts. And you'll see when the report is out, the numbers will vary. You know, we keep a lot of solar PV value added compared to employment, and this is really of the kind of UK total-ish. Because a lot of that's involved, it will involve, even for the more, the kind of larger commercial solar PV developments, there's still a lot of people on the ground sticking stuff up, yeah, on roofs and in fields. So a lot of that is construction. And so that's why we keep a lot more of the economic impact in Wales in this case, as opposed to something like onshore wind, where this is quite a slick operation now. You know, certainly large wind farms are put up in reasonably short amounts of time, and you know, a lot, even the transport logistics is not really done by Welsh firms. Many cases, we do have some successes in the energy sector in kind of getting into the supply chains, but not that many. So there's a different kind of level of value added, and of course, you know, the turbines in that case. Yeah. The turbines are a big part of the onshore wind cost. They're not made in Wales. The solar PV panels are much cheaper now than they were, so they're a much smaller part of the overall cost, so we can capture more of the benefit in terms of value added. And there's some numbers then which take us down to city region level, I think potentially with the falling wind, Swansea Bay could capture maybe two-thirds of the impact. Slightly low in terms of value added, slightly high in terms of employment, because you know, if you are looking for kind of specific professional services, specialist professional services, you might go to Cardiff, to Eversheds, or to some of my mates in the audience to do your planning. You wouldn't really, you know, keep that in Swansea, whereas if you're building stuff on the ground in Swansea, you're more likely to use local employees, or employees who are peripatetically living in Swansea temporarily, or commuting into Swansea to take those jobs. Of course, another issue in terms of what you mean by economic impact. Domestic refurbishment, you know, I think we're talking about similar levels of jobs. You know, we're only talking about 20% reduction in carbon here, but again, at a Wales level, I think about 33,000 jobs will be employed in putting in the, this is a mix of insulation, external and internal, other energy efficiency measures, new boilers, heat pumps and so on, hybrid heat pumps, so, you know, the sort of stuff Johnny's talking about. Of course, as the mix of technology changes, as technology develops, that you use for domestic refurbishment, then the amount of jobs required will change also. If you're putting CHPs in instead of kind of individual property level interventions, then this may change quite a lot. But my best guess is we're looking at about 33,000 jobs again, of which the city region might capture about 25,000. And, you know, levels of gross value added per annum, about 40 million pounds per annum, Wales level, but 22 in Swansea. And the cost of that, I think, is over £1 billion. So it's RBED times 30. Not very big, really, is it? But if you want to do it properly, you've got to do this. No point. This is not, it's not a job you can half do. You can't kind of, you know, wash your hands in 2050 and say, oh, well, we stayed under 3 degrees, so that was all right. You can do this, don't do it at all, I guess. Finally, then, to think about capturing wider opportunities. I can't really talk about this, I don't have much time left. I've got five or so minutes. But this is the final sentence from a paper that I wrote to some colleagues, which was published last year. And I won't read it all out. But what it says is that, you know, we have to be really careful. And this is something I do get annoyed with. You know, I'm sorry, I love Mark Drakeford, he's very cuddly. We've been talking about the potential in Wales for renewable energy for at least the 2.5 decades I've been looking at this stuff, and I'm sick to death of it. And there may be technical potential, there's natural potential. We have the escarpments and the topography required for good onshore wind. We certainly have, you know, if you care at all about UK system balancing, then the Western Seas are absolutely where we should be building the next wind farm, so that when the sun, you know, when the sun is shining and it's very still in the North Sea, that the West is still blowing and we get those kind of really useful balancing things. So we, you know, we've got potential on the seashore, and you know, in our seabeds. But you know what? We don't own the seabeds. Yeah, Her Majesty owns the seabeds, and we're renting and leasing out our hills at a trivial cost to people like Vattenfall. And at the same time, we have only a small number of companies, one or two, really steamed in and done really well, particularly North Wales, in capturing some of this kind of higher value stuff. but by and large, no tier one contractors in Wales really to speak of. So if you talk about spending billions of pounds, you immediately are looking for a non-Welsh company. Look at who builds our roads. Yeah. So all these issues mean that we don't capture anywhere near half of, probably near a quarter of, the overall economic impact benefit from energy interventions. And that's not going to change by just deciding that we're going to spend loads of money in Swansea Bay and making it renewable and sustainable. This is exemplified by my last slide, which is looking at community energy. So a couple of years ago, we had a job for Rob Proctor, who's here, I think, Community Energy Wales, looking at how much community energy was being delivered, was on the ground. What you'd normally see at this stage is me having classified these community energy projects by technology type. So you'd have like onshore wind, offshore wind, hydro, solar PV. I don't have to do that. I can put a single slide up with all of them. Yeah, over 50 kilowatt. All of that's as far as we can find every community owned energy or community and charity owned energy installation in Wales of any size at all. Keith Jones was not here. If Keith Jones wasn't involved, Keith Jones hadn't happenstance Keith Jones being Welsh, you can take out the National Trust as well, which is sticking seven, almost a megawatt on. You take the National Trust out of that, which is not a Welsh organisation, then what you've got is not very much in the way of community energy. And that's not CEW's fault, it's not Community Energy Wales's fault. It's fault of a lot of different factors that you can obviously read the paper and find out. But I think that's probably about 0.3% of all renewables in Wales. Is community energy, community and charity energy, which is why Welsh Government have very sensibly chosen local energy as their target, not community energy, same as Scots did. And these are the kind of fundamental barriers to making a difference socioeconomically that we are challenged with, even in a region which is so rich in energy as Wales is, in renewable energy as Wales is. So in conclusion then, if you sum all this up, I think you're probably looking at across renewable energy and domestic refurbishment, about 4,500 jobs created in Wales, and about 3,200 of those in the city region. I've called this the economic opportunity, not the economic impact, which is quite a subtle, sneaky thing to do, because this is assuming that the city region and Wales can ramp up the supply side in order to service this very significant new opportunity, new investment. So, making sure our companies are upskilled and able to compete in whatever replaces OJEU after Brexit. There'll probably be a new UK-level kind of procurement framework that Welsh companies will have to be able to compete under and compete against people like Capita and others. We have to make sure that our education system and our post-15 training systems are putting boots on the ground which are competent boots, where people can get jobs in some of these new sectors. None of that's true at the moment, or not very true, or only partially true. So we've got a long way to go on the supply side to make sure that Wales can actually kind of step up this opportunity. I said other elements I've not talked about are probably more expensive or maybe as expensive. We don't really know yet how much storage is going to cost in order to make this work. And obviously the more you can interact with other city regions and other countries, the better in terms of reducing your storage requirements. This is a daunting investment. Yeah. This is three M4s. I suspect by the end of the year it'll only be two M4s, maybe an M4 and a half. But at the moment you're looking at three M4s worth of investment to make this a reality. But there's no point half doing this. There's no point having a city region which is not quite sustainable. So if you're going to do it, you have to do it at this scale. Thank you very much.